what's served is staggering amounts of food, cooked for enormous banquets. I mean, one requires 100 head of cattle, 130 sheep, 120 pigs, 200 piglets, 200 lambs, 100 calves, 2,000 hens, and 12,000 eggs. And that's not even mentioning the spices, the wine, the fruits, the sugar. This is literally tons of food that took a small army of cooks several weeks to prepare. And all of it, amazingly, is consumed in 2 days of banqueting.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smigel, and like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 14, International Gothic Cuisine. Ironically, the horrific bubonic plagues in 14th century Europe produced societal shifts that led to a resplendent era in food. In today's podcast, we're going to look at the influence of three seminal Gothic-era cookbooks and the craze for spices and sugar and the flourishing of Gothic cuisine. We're going to study specific recipes, take a look at Gothic cooking techniques, and even discuss the culture of medieval court banquets. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
Around the year 1300, Europe was once again bursting at the seams. It had reached that critical threshold of population density, and given the technology available to provide food, it was bound, if we believe Malthus, to suffer some kind of major catastrophe to rebalance the people and the resources. In other words, the Malthusian scissors were waiting to do some cutting. And the first major catastrophe came in the early 14th century, about 1315 to 17, several successive years of crop failure, which meant that any reserves were eaten up. 1 year's failure is not so devastating, maybe, but happens every 10 or 12 years. The prices rise, but you know, people can cope for one season. But when you have several years in a row, then chronic malnutrition causes a sharp and immediate population drop. And it's partly due to people actually dying of starvation. But maybe just as important is a condition known as amenorrhea. You know, severe malnutrition causes a woman's reproductive system to just shut down. So several years of drastically reduced fertility, compounded with the fact that those babies fortunate enough to be born in those years probably malnourished themselves, and then suffered an unusually high infant mortality rate. So the famines of the early 14th century are clearly the start. But they are absolutely nothing compared to the contagious disease that makes its appearance in southern Europe in 1348. Now, how it gets there is the most fascinating part of this story. In the preceding century, Genghis Khan and his Mongol hordes had conquered all of China, all of Central Asia, and most importantly, Persia, bringing the Abbasid dynasty to an end. But it was also by coincidence that at the same time that Europe had become once again hooked up to those trade routes, extending all the way into the Middle East. In other words, Europe is now directly in contact with people who have traversed the entire length of Asia. Now, why are they linked? It's those spices. It's the luxury items that come from the East. And it just so happens that the Mongols traversed part of Central Asia where this virus was endemic among a population of black rats. That means they always carry it. The pathogen is a Yersinia pestis, a bacillus, or that's a rod-shaped bacterium, that had thrived among these rats for many generations and, in fact, had learned to live with their rat hosts rather than killing them off. You know, these are smart germs learning to live with the host. You know, it's kind of like the common cold or maybe the flu with us today. So this bacterium was also particularly ingenious because it had figured out a way to get itself transferred from the bloodstream of one rat into another. And it did this by hitching a ride on fleas. Fleas are the vector, rats are the host. And if the infected flea then bites a human, as apparently often happened, you know, I think that the flea gets the sensation of being starved and it begins to bite anything indiscriminately. And then the human gets infected too. But note, the bacteria has not yet learned to live with humans. And at this point, it infects us quickly, but it kills us off immediately. Now, why? Well, think, when was the last plague? That's the plague of Justinian back in 542-3. That's 800 years before. And this virus had evolved in ways that made it very unfamiliar with humans, in Europe at least. So when the plague first hits Europe in 1348, it is absolutely devastating. And there are probably even several varieties at work. The most important was bubonic plague, named for the buboes or booboos, these large black swellings that occur in the armpits and groin and in the lymph nodes. They have a characteristic red ring around them, hence ring around the rosy. You know, pocket full of posies, we all drop dead. But without lingering on these gruesome details, it usually kills you within a few days. But how it was able to travel so quickly from the Black Sea to Sicily to southern France and up to northern Europe within 1 year is also central to this story. In the course of the Reconquista, Spain and Portugal were gradually pushing out the Moors, if you remember. By 1291, that process is largely complete, except Granada. But the Straits of Gibraltar were now controlled by Christians, which meant that ships could get from the Mediterranean out into the Atlantic, up into northern Europe, and it was trade that facilitated the rapid spread of plague. The infected rats stow away on ships, they bring their fleas, and that's always a price to be paid for progress, for civilization, for luxury items. And we'll see, this is not the only time, not the last time, that this lust for spices is a major catalyst in world history. So what are the consequences? About one-third of all Europeans perished in this first outbreak. Some towns were completely depopulated. About 35 million people died. Now, obviously, that completely dislocates the economy at first. But let's think, what would it do in the long run? Remember, the survivors are the ones who inherit the spoils. And the price of labor goes way up because it's in great demand. There aren't enough workers. That means their wages rise. And because there is not a lot of people to populate the land, the price of land goes way down because landlords are kind of desperate to get tenants. So they start making very attractive deals. They offer fixed rents or even more importantly, manumission rights. In other words, serfdom, because of plagues, falls apart because peasants are in a position to dictate the terms now. And of course, there's a lot of grumbling among the nobles because they're desperately trying to hold on to their privileges. And they try to pass all sorts of restrictive laws that lead to a whole series of peasant uprisings in the later 1300s. But for our purposes, the lot of the average peasant, really ironically, improves dramatically. And most food historians are in agreement that the average peasant ate more meat, consumed more alcohol, was generally much better fed after 1350 than before. And their diet becomes more varied, too. It includes more calories, and most importantly, they could often begin to afford luxury items themselves. And to put this situation another way, the wealth is now spread more evenly among all classes of society. And because there are fewer people around, everyone gets a little bit bigger slice of pie. Literally, I guess. So I'm going to make some rather bold claims here. Okay, bear with me. Thanks to the plague, more people had increased buying power. And despite the overall shrinking of the economy, there were more people able to imitate their superiors. There was developing, if you want to call it this, a kind of middle class. Let's say urban professionals, wealthy rural peasants, people who can really afford luxuries now and who could prepare more elaborate, fashionable dishes and, as we'll see, buy cookbooks. And remember, they're all still in manuscript form. But let's return to my theory. Having a thriving court culture and people able to imitate it is one reason culinary arts thrive. So before, we certainly had a court culture and a handful of nobles who might be able to imitate it, or maybe, you know, who were invited to these noble banquets themselves, but that was a tiny little percent of society. It's now many more people who can afford, say, a roast on Sunday, or a few spices to liven up their food, or some decent imported wine. And again, it is ironic that the people providing these luxuries grow fabulously wealthy. I mean, let me just mention that the Venetians, especially the Venetians, the Genoese, the Pisans, those people dominate the spice trade. The Florentines specialize in providing credit. The Flemish cities that are making wool into tapestries and cloth. The Dutch who are supplying Europe with salt fish and herring for Lent. The German Hanseatic League cities trading with the Baltic who supply Europe with timber, hides, iron, as well as grain from Eastern Europe. And in fact, Eastern Europe is interesting. Serfdom never really disappears there. So it becomes the breadbasket in a sense. It's a few regions that flourish, but they become obscenely wealthy in the Middle Ages because of this brisk trade in both basic foods and in luxury items. It is also not surprising that it's in these places that late medieval cuisine flourishes. And it does so in the wealthy capitals of emerging nation states, London, Paris. And those are becoming increasingly kind of administrative, financial, and legal centers of their respective countries. Now, why is that important? Who are these people? Those are middle-class bureaucrats, tradesmen, bankers. There's lots of money circulating all over the place, and people really want to spend it, right? So let me talk about some of these medieval cookbooks. Realize that those that have survived are prepared usually for noble or royal households. A few are designed for bourgeois families, but that in itself suggests a trickling down of culture, right? And also the spread of fashion from country to country, because there's actually an amazing amount of similarity among these cookbooks, even though they come from different regions. In other words, medieval elite cuisine is very international. Rulers wanted to eat like their fellow rulers in other countries. So we see all the same kinds of recipes across Europe. The most important medieval cookbooks, I should say many different versions, but there's what's called the Viandier of Théavant. Viandier kind of means, comes from the word viande for meat in French, but it's also a person who prepares any kind of victuals. So it's, you know, it's the chef, incidentally. But these are actually a collection of recipes, probably from as early as the 13th century, that were gathered together and adapted by this guy named Guillaume Tirel, who gets the nickname Théavant. And Théavant means to slice wind. I don't know what he's doing in the kitchen, but he's doing something like that. Tirel became chef to King Charles V of France and enjoyed immense popularity at the French court. And he was even ennobled. He gets a coat of arms with three stew pots on it. So he becomes chef to the king in 1370. And this cookbook that he gathered together sometimes from other sources, but it influenced this whole generation of chefs who wanted to imitate the renowned culinary exploits of this chef and the grand banquets of the king, who is reputed to be the most refined gourmand in Europe. And Tirel becomes, in a sense, not just the arbiter of taste for Europe, he's kind of like a celebrity chef in a way. The second great cookbook of this period, and this is to prove my point, is called the Ménager de Paris. Ménager means a householder. He's not working for kings, okay? It's suggested that the author was a lawyer, but he's some kind of business person. And significantly, it's written in the late 1300s for a wealthy bourgeois household. You can tell by the size of the meals that are prepared and things. And it takes the form of a book of advice written by a mature, if maybe even elderly man, for his new young bride, who's only 15 years old, and presumably needs some direction concerning what do I do in the kitchen, you know, so she can serve her new husband. In fact, the assumption is that the older man is going to die at one point, and she's going to have to remarry, and is going to need to have a good catch, so she's going to need to know how to cook. It's an odd thing, but that's the way the book is written. But in any case, the book is pretty concrete proof that culinary techniques are trickling down the social ladder, because he borrows and adapts recipes from Teyavant. And also, of course, they're being passed from generation to generation. And what's particularly interesting is that, again, he's teaching this young bride all of these skills that she would need to get another husband when she's a widow, okay? So it includes things like household advice, information about cleaning, morality, how to maintain a budget, take care of horses, but it really has good recipes too, okay? So the third great French cookbook dates from 1420, it's a little later, and actually comes from a region that's now part of Italy. It's the Dukedom of Savoy. The Duke Amadeo VIII got his personal chef, this is Master Chicard d'Amixo, to write down all of his best recipes and explain how to throw a banquet. And obviously, the idea here is to make the chef famous, but most importantly, make that patron famous, right? Spread out his name and make him well-known. And it's interesting that it's written in French, because that's actually the language of the court at the time. And their capital is actually on the side that's in Chambéry, which is now France. But in any case, the book is called Du Fait de Cuisine, on doing cookery, I guess. It's written for professionals. And people have, historians have often called it the first true cookbook of the Middle Ages, because it explains not just culinary techniques, but how you put the dishes together to form a whole meal. In other words, it's got complete menus in it. It has directions on how to plan a banquet, which is, of course, exactly what every nobleman wants to know how to do. So they get copies of Chicard for their own chef, right? They don't want to be outdone by the Duke of Savoy, right? What's served is staggering amounts of food, cooked for enormous banquets. I mean, one requires 100 head of cattle, 130 sheep, 120 pigs, 200 piglets, 200 lambs, 100 calves, 2,000 hens, and 12,000 eggs. And that's not even mentioning the spices, the wine, the fruits, the sugar. This is literally tons of food that took a small army of cooks several weeks to prepare. And all of it, amazingly, is consumed in 2 days of banqueting. So there are a lot of people there, too. And presumably, all this extravagance really paid off, because Amadeo, the Duke, was elected Pope Felix V in 1439.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from how the Bible was made, exoplanets, word etymology, geology, reasoning skills, staying fit as you get older, and a whole lot more. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
I have already mentioned the craze for spices and sugar and coloring foods. And incidentally, the spices, let me mention that now, they're not to hide the odor of rancid meat. That's one of the most persistent fallacies about this cuisine. Anyone who can afford spices would not have to eat anything but the freshest meat. So I don't think their use was primarily medicinal either. I mean, some medievalists argue that their primary role was as a condiment to correct foods that are humorally imbalanced. I think mostly it's a taste thing, right? I mean, spices are interesting and sometimes a little odd, and they're exotic. And I do believe that people use them in great quantities. If you're trying to show off your wealth by serving spiced foods, are you going to give it a little pinch or two? You want everyone to know you're blowing a big wad of money on this stuff, and so you overdo it. And I think it has been a big mistake of many medieval food historians to say, well, of course they used it in small quantities just to accent food, much like we would, because otherwise it wouldn't taste good. Well, that's, you know, a backward way of thinking of things. I think like anything, once you get started, you need more and more flavor. It's kind of like chili peppers, you know, they don't satisfy unless there's a little bit of burn. Well, spices really do have heat like that too, if you use enough of it. But the question really still remains open, because There are not cookbooks that offer precise quantities, right? So pharmaceutical texts often do. And I would argue, in any case, from the suggestions that are there and from household accounts and books like that, I think they do use a lot of spices. I also think there is no such thing as universal standards of taste across time and place. And many historians assume that it won't taste good if you throw a handful of sugar and cinnamon on a piece of meat, so it must have been a pinch. Well, wouldn't taste good by whose standard, right? Ours, not theirs. And this is one of those things, I dare anyone to try it sometime. It actually tastes very good. For example, a poudre fort, which is sugar and ginger and sometimes cinnamon and a whole slew of spices. From this point all the way through the 16th century, it was standard to keep this poudre fort, means strong powder, on hand, either that or a poudre douce. In fact, the Ménager says to use white ginger, that's a dried root, canela, cloves, grains of paradise, and sugar, and basically he tosses it on everything, you know, sort of the way we would use salt and pepper. And there's really no particular reason why salt and pepper became universal flavorings. You know, why not sugar and cinnamon, right? I mean, it's really one of those weird, let's call it an accident of history, that we only use sugar in dessert courses. I mean, there are obviously historical reasons why that happens. I'll get to them in a few lectures down the road. I've also mentioned the preference for finely chopped or pounded or sieved foods. And I think that probably had to do with people mostly eating with their hands, right? It maybe had something to do with bad teeth, or maybe there's a medicinal logic of needing to finely combine all the foods of different qualities so their humoral properties kind of meld together and are more easily digested. One food historian suggests that. I don't entirely agree, or at least I've never seen rationale like that in the medical literature of the period. But there is a prevalence of pies, and I think that has a lot to do with people wanting foods they can pick up with their fingers, or cut up food that's cut up in small pieces and is relatively tender and, you know, sort of cooked in its own gravy. But something I haven't mentioned much is that the most common thickening agent was bread. And that would be either finely pounded, or you take a stale piece of bread and you grate it. It's really a very good idea. You know, obviously you're not wasting anything, but it does sort of meld in with a sauce and break down and become thick. It's kind of the way, if you think about it, a good gazpacho gets thick. And gazpacho, if you can think beyond the tomato, is really a very medieval kind of soup. Before that, it's usually made with almonds or pine nuts or something like, or vegetables, but cold and pounded and thickened with bread. What medieval chefs don't have is the amalgamation of flour and butter, called a roux, or gravies that are made of stock thickened with cooked flour. And they don't have any of those fat-based sauces, things like hollandaise and mayonnaise or bechamel. Those are inventions of the 17th century. We'll get to them, but just put those out of your mind now. The classical French idea of a sauce that kind of accentuates the flavor of the main ingredient and is usually made from it. Here, sauces are completely different. They almost always contrast with the main dish. So a sauce will be sour, or sweet, or sometimes both. It'll be spicy, and they're often used as dipping sauces, quite often. Or they're ground up, or they're baked within a pie, something like that. As for the cooking procedures, they still do a good deal of roasting, they still enjoy game, but there's really a heavy emphasis on domestic meats, more so in an urban environment, obviously like Ménager, he can't go out and hunt, but usually roasted meats that are considered humorally moist, things like pork or lamb, which would dry out and make it more balanced and healthy if you roasted them. And then they boil meats that were considered humorally dry, so things like beef. And keep in mind, these are comparatively small, lean creatures. They're not the big, super fatty steers that we raise today. Birds, although dry, were larded with bacon or fat and roasted, but chicken could really go either way or go into a pie. And veal also is one of those things that can take pretty much any treatment because it's one of those few foods that are humorally balanced. So there's also a good deal of emphasis on frying. It tends to be in lard. The technique is ultimately picked up from the Muslim world, though obviously not the cooking medium. You know, it's just if you have a lot of pigs around, you have lard also. Another misconception about late medieval cooking is that all these people really ate was meat, because that's what all the recipes are for, right? Well, physicians constantly warn people that fruits and vegetables are bad for you, okay? But that's not true at all. They warned that they're harmful for certain complexions. People who are phlegmatic to start with can become sick if they eat cucumbers or melons, but they don't just condemn them outright. And the reason you don't find them in cookbooks is simply that these are things that are simple to prepare or even eaten raw. So dealing with them was not something deemed necessary to discuss because it was simple, right? So in some medieval people did eat fruits and vegetables. In fact, there's a lively trade in them, we know. But it is true that we don't get any really interesting recipes for them until we get to the Renaissance, and then there are many, many. Let's look at in detail at some of these recipes. There is one called a semé of chicken or veal. It's from Le Ménager de Paris, and it's basically a barbecued chicken put in a stew with onion, spices, wine, breadcrumb. But let me share it with you. Grève or semé is a winter pottage. Then fry them in a pot. Now you should have your chicken split down the back and browned on the grill over a charcoal fire. And the same if it is veal. Then you must cut the meat into pieces if it's veal or into quarters if it's chicken and put it in the pot with the onions. Then take white bread, browned on the grill and soaked in broth made from other meat. Then crush ginger, cloves, grains of paradise, long pepper. Moisten them through with verjuice, that's the unripe grape juice, and wine without straining this and set it aside. Then crush the bread, put it through a sieve. Remember, everything wants to be smooth. And add it to the brouet. And brouet is sort of the ancestor of the word broth. Strain everything and boil, then serve. Now notice that the flavoring has changed dramatically. Some of the spices, that are now completely extinct in the West. The sauce, the breadcrumb thickener. But on the other hand, this dish would not be completely unfamiliar, right? I mean, it's grilled chicken over a charcoal fire, and it's in a thick kind of spicy, let's call it a barbecue sauce. Why not, okay? Here's another one. This is a vegetable cheese tart from Le Ménager. And I mention this because it's a kind of quiche. I make it all the time. I love this one. So it says, to make a tort, take 4 handfuls of chard, 2 handfuls of parsley, a handful of charvel, a sprig of fennel, and 2 handfuls of spinach. Trim them and wash in cold water. Then chop very fine. And actually, you can use any greens here. Then crush 2 kinds of cheese, soft and medium. Mix in eggs, yolks, and whites. Beat into the cheese. Then put the herbs in a mortar and pound everything together. Put in some fine powder. That's the spice mix. Take it to the oven. Have a tart made and eat it hot. I mentioned that in the late Middle Ages, they were particularly fond of what were called subtleties. And that's sometimes little edible vignettes made out of sugar, like castles or coats of arms, or sometimes fanciful monstrosities to dazzle and titillate guests. My favorite of these is a peacock, which you remove from its feathers, cook, and then re-sew into its feathers. And then it's presented with a little piece of cotton that's been soaked in camphor and lit. So it comes out and it's spewing flames. That's one thing. The gilded boar's head is another. So it's got real gold hammered and added to the outside of it. And all these, invented creatures, the half chicken, half pig, the sparrow stuffed into a pheasant, stuffed into a duck, stuffed into a goose, the ancestor of the turducken, of course. Or these bizarre multicolored gelatin dishes. There's one which is great. It's called a leech lombard, but I would be willing to bet if you put it on a plate, most people today would say that's a recipe from the 50s. It's sort of lots of different layers of colored gelatin that you slice. Even better, here it is, a blancmange, okay? It is made of cooked and shredded chicken, sugar, almond milk, rose water, sometimes spices, rice starch to bind it, and it's cooked into this kind of solidified chicken pudding. It can also be colored. You can make it yellow with saffron, too. Delightful dish. But to give you an idea of what a banquet would have been like, let me just describe briefly one that happens at the court of the Duke of Burgundy, which is reputed to be the finest in the later Middle Ages. The Burgundian kitchen, the staff, was divided into separate departments. There's one person to supply the bread, another to set the table, lay out the platters and basins, the pantry, right? There's another for just for drinks, which was the butlery or the buttery. And both these departments had maybe 50 assistants each. And then there's the actual cooking kitchen staff. There's the head chef, a separate purchaser, a man in charge of all the spices and dry ingredients, and he would also put the fruits out and lay things at the beginning of a meal. And so the Burgundians had this enormous kitchen staff. And that doesn't even include the servers, the carvers, the men who carry in the food, or those who fill the wine goblets. And there are separate people in charge of, say, the linens. There's marshals, there's ushers. I mean, it's very complex. And the Burgundians also invented a strict protocol of how you address someone, what constitutes polite behavior. In other words, courtly etiquette. And for very interesting historical reasons, which mostly have to do with inheritance, the Burgundian model becomes the one that's adopted in most European courts. And everything, especially food, is becoming increasingly ritualized. Rules of who takes precedence, how you bow to your superior. And there's actually an interesting account by this man, Olivier de la Marche, about the etiquette that he observed in 15th century court of Charles the Bold. And this is, interestingly, although it's Burgundy, the court is in what's now Flanders, in the Netherlands. And practically every daily event, especially eating, had these elaborate rituals attached to them. In fact, he thought the spectacle was sort of like the liturgy. There's a procession of ushers, and one bears in the nef, that's the salt cellar. And then there are tasters who make sure that nothing's poisoned. And then there's this elaborate hand-washing ritual with water poured from these exotically shaped pitchers that are in the form of humans or animals, usually lions. They're called aquamanile. And the ritual just continues through the whole meal. So in general, late medieval or Gothic cuisine was international. It appealed to a wide variety of social classes, all of whom tried to get spices when they could, because this is not just a flavoring, it's a mark of social status. And it was, above all, a very artificial style of cooking that loved colors, disguised foods, sharp contrasts of flavor. Now, in the next lecture, we'll see how food changed in this transitional period from the Renaissance into the 16th century. And we'll see there's less emphasis on spices. And we'll see also the dramatic appearance of dairy products.
Thanks for listening to episode 14 of Food, A Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from storytelling, the science of sleep, Mediterranean cooking, birding, money management, you name it. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.